Well, you know, I want to talk about U.S. foreign policy and then relate it to the question of Yugoslavia. U.S. leaders are telling us that they are in Yugoslavia now only for the best reasons. U.S. national interests are at stake. They never say what those interests are. Stability. We want to bomb for stability. It really stabilizes the country when you bomb them. We also we want to go in for humanitarian interests. And yet in the last 50 years, the U.S. national security state, by the U.S. national security state I mean the White House, the Pentagon, Joint Chiefs of Staff, the State Department, the CIA, the Defense Department, I said that, the Pentagon, and a few other groups, agency groups. In the last 50 years, the U.S. national security state has been a key force in overthrowing reformist governments, democratic governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Dominican Republic, Brazil, Chile, Iran under Mossadegh, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece twice, Argentina twice, Haiti, Bolivia, and other countries, that's not a complete list, and replaced them with pro-capitalist right-wing military regimes that opened up their countries to U.S. multinational corporate investments, opened up their countries with cheap labor, said, come on in, boys, here it is, there's no labor unions, and if they do get out of line, we crack them hard with our Guardia Civile, who are trained, equipped, and financed by you, our soldiers. There's no occupational safety laws. There's no environmental protection laws. There's no child labor laws. Come on in. The natural resources are yours. Do what you want. Just make sure you give me a cut and you protect the interests of my class. U.S. has been active in covert actions or proxy mercenary wars against popular revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique. 1 million people killed in Mozambique by RENAMO. Did you hear about it? Did you hear about the humanitarian necessity to do something about it? Did you hear about the suffering of the people of Mozambique in your media, on your New York Times? In your evening newspapers, did you hear about it? You didn't hear a word, did you? There's still a war going on in Angola that's been going on for about 12 years now. 3 million people killed. The U.S. is in there. You didn't hear about it? Did you hear about the atrocities, the murders, the burning of the villages, the mutilations that would make anything you can imagine, even what the propaganda machines are reporting about Bosnia and Kosovo, make that like kids play? But you didn't hear a word about it, because those two wars, Angola and Mozambique, those two wars are supported by the CIA. They're supported to overthrow revolutionary governments that have the temerity to want to organize a different kind of system where the land and the labor and the resources of the society would be used for and by the people rather than extracted for the capital accumulation process of the multinational corporations. That's the difference. You see, all of humanity is divided into two groups, three groups, really. Group A is made up of those people who live off the interest on their bonds, their stock dividends, the royalty earnings on their land and mineral holdings, the rents on their property, and that sort of stuff. Group B and C, which is the other 98.9% of the world's population, actually more, 99 point something percent of the world's population, they live primarily off wages, salaries, fees, savings, pensions, and that stuff. Primarily, they may have a little investment here, whatever, but that's it. Group C is made up of millions of people who are in utter destitution, who don't even get regular wages or salaries and such, and they live from hand to mouth in total, absolute, desperate destitution. That's the world. And U.S. foreign policy has been directed to making the world safe for the people in Group A. Those are the people who pick who's going to run for president of the United States. Those are the people who pay the enormous expenses for their campaigns. Those are the people who have the high-paid lobbyists. Those are the people who own the media. The corporate media are owned by the same class interests that are giving you this war. Jim Petras called me up the other day. He said, look at the New York Times page, something, I forget what date it was. And there was a story about how back in 1991, before a blue ribbon crowd of very rich people, there was paraded, and the reporter called it a blue ribbon, like a blue ribbon cattle show. There came the candidates who were going to run for president, and selected out of them was Bill Clinton. And Jim said to me, now if you, Mike Parenti, had written that, they would have said, what vulgar Marxism. That isn't the way the system works. There it was, right there in the paper. I looked at the Bilderberg Conference. The Bilderberg Conference is an international conference made up of all the economic and political elites, with some few intellectuals sometimes there to write the papers for them and all that. And of course, from all the different nations around the world, the nations with the money, and I turned, of course, to the United States to see. And the first name was no surprise. The first name was David Rockefeller of Rockefeller Brothers Association, New York City. And the second name struck was rather odd. This was back in 1991. It said, the Honorable Bill Clinton, Governor of Arkansas. I didn't know much about him except that he was the only governor who let his National Guard go down to El Salvador for counterinsurgency maneuvers, so, which means he was already hooked in with the national security state when he was governor. And I said, what the hell is the governor of Arkansas doing at this international conference, you know, this supranational thing? What's he doing? And I found out. About 6 months later, he was announced that he was running for president, and the media started announcing that he was the front runner. I said, how do they know that the governor of Arkansas is suddenly the front runner when there hasn't even been a primary yet? Well, they were right, weren't they? The U.S. has actively engaged in covert actions, as I said, or proxy mercenary wars in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, and elsewhere. Not a complete list. The U.S. has been involved in political actions, subversions, destabilizations against reformist governments in Egypt under Nasser, Lebanon, Peru, Iran, Syria, Zaire, Jamaica, the Fiji Islands, Afghanistan. Afghanistan before the Soviets ever went into that country. Since World War II, U.S. direct military invasions with U.S. forces or aerial attacks or both have been involved. U.S. forces have been involved in Vietnam, Dominican Republic, North Korea, Laos, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq, Somalia, Yugoslavia. All this is a matter of public record, but it's not much taught. It's rarely mentioned in the mainstream media. But why does a professedly peace-loving leadership like the U.S. leaders, see, I don't want to say it's the United States really that's doing it, it's not the U.S. Do you see demonstrations outside, people saying, let's support terrorist groups in Mozambique to destabilize Mozambique. Let's overthrow Angola. Let's get in there and kill more people in Nicaragua. You don't see demonstrations like that. You see demonstrations saying, let's stop doing those things. So it's not the U.S. It's U.S. leaders. It's the Bill Clintons. It's the guys who represent the interest in column A. It's the ones who are at the Blue Ribbon Cattle shows. It's the ones who belong to the Council of Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Conference and the National Security State fringes and sodality groups. Why would these peace-loving leaders find it necessary to use so much violence and repression against so many people in so many places? An important goal, I say, is of U.S. policy is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. governments that strive for any kind of economic independence, governments that strive for any sort of populist redistributive politics, that attempt to use some of their economic surplus for not-for-profit services that benefit the people, in group B and C, such governments are the ones most likely to feel the wrath of U.S. intervention or sanctions or direct invasion. The designated enemy can be a reformist, populist military government, as in Panama, under Trujillo. Trujillo came in, and the Panamanian military turned out to be leftist. They started all sorts of social programs. They started expanding education opportunities, public health programs. They started using the national resources. They cracked down on the drug trade that was going on under Trujillo, and even under Noriega, although he was no Trujillo. He tried to play both sides of the street, but Bush went after Noriega, not because he was a drug lord, but because he wouldn't cooperate in the anti-Sandinista war in Nicaragua. It could be a reformist, populist military government, as in Egypt under Nasser, in Peru under Velasco, in Portugal after Salazar, when the generals tried to make some changes in Portugal. It could be a Christian socialist government, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas, a social democracy popular front, as in Chile under Allende, or Jamaica under Michael Manley, or Greece under Papandreou in 1965, and the Dominican Republic under Juan Bosch, all of them overthrown by U.S. intervention policies. Or it could be a Marxist-Leninist government, as in Cuba, Vietnam, and North Korea, or an Islamic revolutionary order, as in Libya under Gaddafi, or even a conservative militarist regime, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein, ladies and gentlemen, Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put in by the CIA. His job was to stop the Iraqi revolution. He crushed the Kurdish International Reformist Party. He crushed the Iraqi Tudeh Party, which was a communist party. But he also did something else. He refused to be a good boy and play ball with the Seven Sisters oil cartels on the oil prices. And he wanted a better cut for Iraq. And he was making some changes. And Iraq, for everything else you can say about him, Iraq still had the highest standard of living in the Middle East of any country there. Don't take my word for it. Listen to George Bush. President George Bush and Brent Scowcroft just wrote a book on the whole Iraqi war, the Gulf War, where they admit the issue was oil. They said it. Those of us who were saying it then say, oh, you're being economistic, you're being reductionist, you're being conspiratorial. We would just go in and kill just to protect oil profits? Or would we? No, we don't do that at all. They go in and they kill and they protect their oil profits. I remember when George Bush was president and he said, we have our interests, our vital interests. You know, that dynamic, fiery way he has to talk. You listen to him, you go, oh, Georgie hit me with it. Oh, George Bush. Oh. There was a very cruel feminist who said once, I forget who she was, I forget her name. She said, George Bush reminds every woman of her first husband. And you're wondering where I'm diving to. The water is down there. These lecterns are built by people who never have to use them, I can tell you that. And so they don't have things like a little shelf here, some place to put the water. Well, George Bush reminds every woman of her first husband. I laughed, you know, and then I started thinking about that, and I called up my ex-wife. I said, do I remind you of George Bush ever, anytime? She said, what are you talking about? I felt much better then. He said, what was it I wanted to say about George Bush? What? Right. He said, our oil interests. I said, our, or this use of this word we and our, you know, we got to stop doing that thing. We go in and we kill here and we do that, and we have to stop that. No, it deprives us of our we, and it presumes a community interest with they, with them. He said, our oil interests. So I got very excited, you know. I said, oil interests? I ran over to my filing cabinet to pull out my stock portfolio to see how much oil stock I own in Exxon and such, and I discovered I didn't even have a stock portfolio. I said, oh, well, George Bush and his sons are probably keeping it in trust for me and my son. Well, the U.S. has also been the most active promoter or protector of drug traffickers. International drug traffickers who serve the gangster functions of U.S. policy: terror, assassination, intimidation, destabilization, violence when necessary. In the late 1940s, the CIA made deals with Corsica and Sicilian drug mafia and gave them free hands while they used their thugs to destroy the militant and honest but politically left communist longshore unions in Marseille and in Italy. In southern France. The Southeast drug lords of during the Vietnam era, active collaboration with the CIA in the U.S., the Golden Triangle, it was called. And by the way, you know who the major victims were in the first market? What was the first market of that Golden Triangle, all those drug lords, those Southeast Asians? GIs, the man said it, that's right. What was a market, a rich market right near there, of almost 500,000 young men with money, by Indo-Chinese standards, with plenty of spending money, despairing, facing death, not knowing what to do? Drugs came pouring in. That's your CIA, that's your great American agency protecting American interests, protecting our way of life. In Afghanistan, the Mujahideen. In the Washington Post, it was right there. It said, with the Mujahideen winning and the revolutionary government of Afghanistan overthrown, the Soviets leaving, there will be now a marked increase in the heroin trade. For these were the very same people who were raising the poppy and producing the heroin that found its way into Europe and into the U.S. Imagine that. I saw that right in the Washington Post. Blazoned right out there on page 22, the 42nd paragraph of a story. Can you imagine if that was the Sandinistas? Can you imagine if that was Fidel Castro? We'd still be hearing about it every night. But there was a little item, and you can find those things, by the way, in the paper every so often. Remarkable little things where they slip in something. Nicaragua, the Contras, John Hull, the cocaine epidemic that hit U.S. Streets and inner cities in the 1980s. Cocaine, I remember cocaine was an upper class recreational drug. See, when it goes to the upper class, it's called a recreational drug. It was used by business executives, Hollywood people, you know, lawyers, stuff like that. Coke was it was a very expensive thing. By the 1980s, it was coming in, and coming in concentrated form, too, in the form of crack, even more deadly. Cocaine epidemics, low price, affordable. And now the Kosovo Albanians. Let me read to you today's San Francisco Chronicle, quoting a statement by Interpol from November 1997. Kosovo Albanians hold the largest share of the heroin market in Switzerland, Austria, Belgium, Germany, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Norway, and Sweden. That's who we are allied with now. That's who we are told are freedom fighters. The poverty of the third world is not an original condition. It was imposed by colonizing forces. Walter Rodney wrote a very interesting book. He called it How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. I liked it because the word underdeveloped was being used as a verb. Europe underdeveloped Africa. Africa was not underdeveloped. Africa had civilizations. Africa had agriculture technology. Africa had all sorts of irrigation technologies, all sorts of construction technologies, had all sorts of things. What it didn't have was a technology in violence and force and destruction that could match the European technology. That's where it lost out. And what's happened is that these countries have become underdeveloped. Their lands were taken away from them, given over to commercial cash export crops. Their mining and minerals, the timber, they themselves were killed or worked to death in the mines. This is what the Belgians did in the Congo, the French did in parts of Africa, Algiers and such. The Germans did it in Southwest Africa, where they killed 60,000 Herero tribesmen and took the other 20,000 and worked them to death to build the mines and the railroads for them. So what the process that's going on through the third world is deracination, which is driving people off the land, de-skilling them, making them dependent consumers, and turning them into a subsistence labor, cheap labor pool. And that process is going on today, the same process that went on in England in the 17th century, 18th century. Let's take the case of India. In 1800, India exported more finished textile goods to England than vice versa. By 1830, the British had put up these tariff walls and were dumping goods in India and came in with their gunboats and dismantled the great Indian textile centers of Dhaka and Madras and sent the people back off onto the land to grow the cotton, to be the cow, the raw material cow that would be milked, while the manufacturing and the marketing and the profits would go to England. And they'd have to buy now their textiles when they used to make good textiles, and they had to buy them from England. So you had this de-industrializing of the people. And of course, when you don't have that much left to sell back, a debt grows up. And the debt in India grew to 53 million pounds from 1850 to 1900. In that same period, the per capita income in India declined by 65%, almost two-thirds. It was England underdeveloping India, teaching them poverty. It wasn't that they didn't know how to work, they have too many babies, the climate made them, it was so warm, made them lazy and all that. They had their own industries. It was forcibly, with Gatling guns and gunboats and the sword and the whip and the gun, they de-industrialized the country. In Ireland, Frederick Engels, Karl Marx's collaborator, taking a trip in 1856, and Ireland is the oldest imperialism, 800 years. White people, Europeans. You see, it's not racism. They don't go to Asia and Africa because they just don't like people of color and they want to do them in. They go because there's wealth there. These countries are rich. Africa is rich. Asia is rich. Latin America was rich. You don't go to poor places to get money. You go to rich places and you get those resources and you get that other resource they have, which is their labor. Only the people are poor. The people are poor, but it doesn't mean the country is poor. And the same with Ireland. But then after they're there and they got to kill you, we come in and we kill your men and we rape your women and we spit your babies on bayonets and we burn your houses and we burn your little mines and we burn your crops and slaughter your herds. We got to justify that. And we say, these blacks, these browns, these yellows, these reds, they're morally inferior. They're just savages, we're coming in to help them. You reverse the role of victim and victimizer, the white man's burden, we're here to help them. So racism becomes a very useful thing, you see. But that imperialism will be used against whites too. That destruction will be used against whites. The first imperialism was by Western Europe against Eastern Europe. And the oldest imperialism of the British Empire was against Ireland, which was also white. And today they're bombing a European Caucasian people in Serbia. So when push comes to shove, and the bottom line is at stake, you could even be a white brother, it doesn't matter. It's the question is, are you in column A or column B? That is really the important thing. And this is what Engels had to say when he traveled through Ireland. How often have the Irish started out to achieve something, and every time they've been crushed politically and industrially by consistent oppression, they have been artificially converted into an utterly impoverished nation. That's the key term, artificially converted. So these people are not underdeveloped. They are maldeveloped. They are overexploited. The Mayan Indians in Guatemala back in the 1600s had a better diet, more calories, more proteins, better conditions of health and health treatment. They had more artists and musicians, more architects and horticulturalists, more than they have today. Before the Europeans came, they are not underdeveloped, they are overexploited. Now we turn to Yugoslavia. Can it really be that the U.S. national security state is so moved? This CIA that involves itself in acts of destabilization, sabotage, propaganda, terror, drug trafficking, torture, death squads, it's so moved out of humanitarian concerns for the Albanians in Kosovo that it's intervening now and bombing Kosovo and all the rest of Serbia and Montenegro. Is it humanitarian compassion that compels U.S. forces to be bombing three countries at this very time, Yugoslavia, Iraq, and occasionally Sudan, to be involved in proxy wars in Angola, Colombia, and a half dozen other countries? If it's oppressed minorities U.S. leaders are worried about, why doesn't Clinton bomb Turkey for what they've done to the Kurds? I mean, why don't you go out and bomb the Turkish people for what these Turkish military leaders did to the Kurds? Why don't you go out and bomb the Indonesian people and kill them for what their leaders did, killing 200,000 East Timorese? Why doesn't Clinton bomb Israel for what it's done to the Palestinians? Why doesn't he bomb the Czech Republic and a half a dozen other countries for their mistreatment of the Romani people, who we call gypsies? Why doesn't he bomb Guatemala for the systematic slaughter of tens of thousands of Mayan villages? In fact, the U.S. wouldn't bomb these. The U.S. has been behind them, aiding, equipping, training, and financing them to clean them out of the place, deracinate it, to stop them from thinking that they can organize and resist and build an alternative kind of system. Why doesn't he bomb Britain for oppressing the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland? You know, drop a bomb on his girlfriend, Tony Blair. Tony Blair is Bill Clinton in drag, isn't he? Why doesn't he bomb the Hutu for the mass murder of a half a million Tutsis in Rwanda? And why doesn't he bomb the French who were totally complicit in that massacre? And while Clinton is at it, why doesn't he bomb himself for the treatment accorded Native Americans, African Americans, and working people in general in this country? In 1919, a noted conservative economist, a conservative by the name of Joseph Schumpeter, he presented this picture of ancient Roman imperialism, the Roman Empire. He wrote this in 1919, now it's almost a century ago. That policy which pretends to aspire to peace but unerringly generates war, the policy of continual preparation for war, the policy of meddlesome interventionism. There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why then, it was the national honor that had been insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their indubitably aggressive designs. They were enemies who only waited to fall on the Roman people. Does that sound familiar at all to you? John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State under Eisenhower, a conservative Republican. In order to bring a nation to support the burdens of maintaining great military establishments, it's necessary to create an emotional state akin to war psychology. There must be the portrayal of external menace. This involves the development to a high degree of the nation hero, nation villain ideology, and the arousing of the population to a sense of sacrifice. Once these exist, we've gone a long way on the path to war. Yugoslavia was built on an idea. Not many nations are. The idea was that after the breakup of the Habsburg Empire, after World War I, the Southern Slavs, that's what Yugoslav means, Southern Slav, The Southern Slavs would not remain a weak and divided people, falling out among themselves or falling prey to imperial interests. They were going to unite. They could form a very substantial territory. You take a look at the original Yugoslavia. It was a good-sized country in Europe, capable of its own economic development and self-determination. And certainly after World War II, multi-ethnic socialist Yugoslavia was a post-war industrial power with an economic success. Between 1960 and 1980, it had one of the most vigorous growth rates, a decent standard of living, free medical care and education, guaranteed right to a job, 1 month free vacation with pay, affordable public transportation, housing and utilities, literacy was over 90%, life expectancy was 72 years, most of the economy was in the public, not for private sector. Now, such a country is not the kind that global capitalism would normally tolerate, certainly not in Europe. But still, Yugoslavia was allowed to exist for another 45 years because it acted as a buffer and even as a wedge to the Warsaw Pact nations. It would not join the Warsaw Pact and have an independent system, internationally. At the same time, efforts were made to undermine the socialistic features of the Yugoslav economy. Yugoslav leaders made the same mistake that the Polish communist leaders did. They said, we're going to build up our industrial base even more, mass industrial base, basic industry, and we're also going to increase consumer production and consumption. Now, how do you do that? How can you do both of those at the same time? Very simply, we'll borrow from the West. And once they've started borrowing from the West, the IMF camel got its nose into the tent, and IMF penetration came with this enormous debt. And with this debt, the IMF demands for restructuring. Restructuring is a euphemism that they use. It means a harsh austerity program, cutbacks in public sector spending, wage cuts, unemployment, the abolition of worker-managed enterprises. Those are the kind of things you force your people to work harder, consume less, so you can start paying off this debt now that I have on you, these billions of dollars. Still, much of the economy was still public sector, not for profit, including the very rich reserves of minerals and other natural resources in Kosovo and other parts of Yugoslavia. Then came another blow. In November 1990, George Bush got the U.S. Congress to pass the 1991 Foreign Appropriations Law. You say, U.S. policy was to systematically break up and dismember Yugoslavia. Now that the Soviet bloc was gone, we didn't need Yugoslavia anymore. We did not have to tolerate a socialist country right there in the middle of Europe. So you break it up into a bunch of small right-wing banana republics. Oh, you have a conspiracy theory? You think they really plotted this? It's ancient ethnic enmities. That's what it was. Well, really? Well, then what's the U.S. Congress doing in November 1990, passing this law, which says as follows, all aid and credits to Yugoslavia will be cut off. Now, conducting trade without credits is virtually impossible in the modern world, especially for an indebted country that lacked a hard currency. The law was a terrible blow to the Yugoslav economy. Then came the sweetener. Aid will go to Yugoslavia, not to the national government, but aid will go only to the individual republics on our terms. And one of the conditions is that that you have separate elections in all six Yugoslav republics. And these elections have to be approved by the U.S. State Department. Excuse me? Who has sovereignty in Yugoslavia? The U.S. State Department? We will approve the election procedures and the results. I thought that was fascinating. We will approve the results, what the outcomes will be. And in fact, the aid went only to those forces whom the U.S. defined as democratic, meaning small, right-wing, ultra-nationalist, and even fascistic parties. Tuđman in Croatia. Izetbegović in Bosnia, a right-wing Muslim who had been in an SS formation, a Nazi, ex-Nazi, Tuđman, who wrote a book on the Holocaust, which said it wasn't that bad, and not that many Jews were killed. Tudjman, who has a military force now in Croatia, that salutes like this with the straight-arm Nazi salute, and the old Ustasa checkered flag, which was a totally Nazi collaboration group. That's who we supported. That's who they supported in Yugoslavia to come forward. And so, for the first time in 45 years, all sorts of ultra-nationalist and fascist groups started emerging in Yugoslavia with money and with confidence and with terrorist tactics, with the full knowledge and confidence that they had the U.S. national security state and the whole Western capitalist military world to their backs, supporting them. Why would they do all this? Why would they want to privatize and deindustrialize Yugoslavia? They wanted Yugoslavia's rich natural resources to be at the disposal of multinational corporations. They want a population that's hungry, that works at subsistence wages. They want an economy that offers no competition with existing capitalist producers. You see, you have no right. Where do you get off making your own refrigerators or vacuum cleaners or that sort of thing? Where do you get off owning your own land? That land should belong to us. We could know how to use it and really profit from it. And where do you get off expecting a living wage? Don't you understand? Don't you understand the problems, the burdens of the people in column A? Don't you understand that every dollar I've got to pay you on stupid things like wages or pensions, or every dollar I've got to spend on occupational safety or environmental regulations that these stupid meddlesome governments are putting in, is one less dollar for me? Don't you understand that? And that's what the game is about. It's about capital accumulation. It's about who skims the cream in the world. Undoing the petroleum, engineering, mining, and automotive industries in Yugoslavia, and abolishing public sector services and social programs. Now, what is it, Parenti? Are you paranoid again? I mean, why would U.S. policymakers want to abolish Yugoslavia's social programs? Do you think they're such evil-spirited people? Well, why do they want to abolish our social programs? Would you mind looking a little closer to home? As they have been doing. Social security, aid to families with dependent children, public health services, all cut back, public education, scholarships, all cut back, public hospitals cut back, library services cut back, gotta cut it back, gotta pay for those missiles, gotta pay for those $1 million cruise missiles. Each of one has a computer on it that can contour the landscape as it goes in to kill people. It's the third worldization of Yugoslavia. It's the third worldization of the USA. I said that in 1992 here in California in the talk. I'm sorry, 1991, and I still say it's the third worldization of the US. That's their goal. Their goal is to have a country with about 15 multi-billionaires owning everything and 240 million peasants working at their rates the way they want. Another goal in the dismemberment of Yugoslavia is ideological monopoly. Last year in Serbian Bosnia, the last remaining radio station that was critical of NATO policy was forcibly taken over by NATO troops and closed down. And the article in the New York Times, the way the mental gymnastics of the reporter who had to explain to readers that the suppressing of this last dissenting voice in Bosnia was necessary to advance democracy. It was really marvelous to watch him do all these flips and twists to explain that to us lesser mortals who don't get the nuanced subtleties of that policy. Yugoslavia, before the bombings began, Yugoslavia allowed opposition radio stations in Serbia, in Montenegro, in Kosovo, dissident newspapers. Every political party had dissident newspapers. Today, Milosevic in his parliament faces more opposition parties elected to that parliament than any other parliament, than any other leader in Western Europe. But it's been repeatedly called a dictatorship. Milosevic was elected in a contest that foreign observers says was fair and honest, with relatively few violations. He's been elected president 3 times, twice the president of Serbia, and most recently the president of the Federation of Yugoslavia. If he is a war criminal, if he's committed war crimes, let's see what they are. Could someone tell me what they are? The Hague War Crimes Tribunal has asked the United States for documentation demonstrating that Milosevic is a war criminal. That has been over a year and a half ago, and they have not gotten any documentation yet. Is he without crimes? I doubt. I doubt any modern leader is pursuing policies that don't have certain effects. Yugoslav TV is still in the hands of people who refuse to look at the world, as does the U.S. State Department and the White House and the U.S. media. Yugoslav TV journalist that I know, Novenka Jovanovic, she was telling me when I met her in Greece, in Athens, at a conference, she said, I asked the U.S. ambassador, I said, what do you want from us? This was 2 years ago. He said, we want your television system. To have, the U.S. imperialists want an ideological monopoly on the world's media, and they've got something close to that already. That is, a media that is owned entirely by people who inhabit column A. In 1992, what was left of Yugoslavia was delivered another blow. International sanctions led by the U.S. A freeze was imposed on all trade with Yugoslavia, including technical and scientific exchanges. 75% of Yugoslav production was hit by this. The results were utter disaster. Hyperinflation, mass unemployment up to 70%, malnourishment, the collapse of the healthcare system at great cost to the population. You see, with sanctions, when you deliver sanctions against a country, the civilian population does not suffer collateral damage, incidental casualties. The civilian population is the prime target. I mean, they are what is being targeted when you do sanctions. To justify all of this, the U.S. public, for the last 8 years, have been given a propaganda barrage, a process of demonization. Violent intervention against any country brings demonization. Don't take my word for it. Listen to a Charles Boyd, former deputy commander of the U.S. European Command, another conservative, said in 1994 in Foreign Affairs. Foreign Affairs is the establishment publication in the U.S. He said that the popular image of this war in Yugoslavia is of unrelenting Serb expansion. In fact, the Serbs have been holding most of these lands for more than 3 centuries. The same is true of most Serb land in Bosnia. They are not taking over land. They're not conquering new territory. They were trying to hold on to what was theirs. The U.S. has punished one side in this war. It has supported the legitimacy of the leadership in the Bosnian Muslim government that has become increasingly ethnocentric in its makeup, single party in its rule, and manipulative in its diplomacy. We say we want peace, but we have encouraged a deepening of the war. That is my thesis, that while the Western powers are portraying themselves as saviors, they have been the prime instigators of these wars and this dismemberment and these civil wars and this and the destruction that's been going on. But what of the atrocities they have committed? Atrocities and executions were committed on all 3 sides, all Bosnian, Muslim, Croatian, and Serbian. You know, when Clinton was going to go in 95, what you got was stories about Serbian atrocities, mass rape. When he decided he wasn't going to go in, because it was very tricky and he didn't want to face a 1996 election in a war up to his ears in Europe, when he decided we weren't going in, our national interests weren't there, suddenly you saw stories coming in about atrocities committed by the Croats, atrocities by the Muslims. And they suddenly, it was different. When he decided later on, 96-7, to go in after the election, suddenly again it was the Serb atrocities were up there. It's like the media follow the policy. It's like the gas on your stove. Up comes the flame, down the flame, up the flame. And it worked. It's remarkable how it works. And it's no conspiracy. How it's done, it's very simple. They come out and they say, this is it, and they start feeding these stories, and the press goes out and doesn't. They change that a little bit, they want to shift it this way, they say, this is it, they report, oh, the president said this is it, Madeleine Albright said this is it, and they feed him a few other stories that way. And so it goes. Atrocities? Show me a war where there are no atrocities. Do you really trust U.S. leaders and corporate-owned U.S. news media on such matters? Don't you remember how your New York Times, your L.A. Times, your Washington Post, don't you remember the stories they printed, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, about the 500 premature babies that the Iraqi soldiers ripped from incubators in Kuwait, laughingly throwing them on hospital floors, the vivid, detailed descriptions with names of particular Kuwaiti people with their age right next to it saying, I saw these babies, that happened, it was terrible. And then later reflection, people thought about it and said, 500 incubator babies in Kuwait? All of LA County has about 50 incubators. About half of them aren't ever being used at any one time. Did Kuwait specialize in premature births? What is this 500? Instead of saying, what the hell's going on here? And we find out only years later that the story was a total fabrication. The story was made up by the daughter of an ambassador and pushed out there by Tom Landos in his congressional committee meetings, and the press picked it all up. If you believe that, you want to keep believing? What about the rapes? Oh, the rapes are starting again. No, my friends, the rape stories are starting again. Show me a war where there aren't rapes, which is not to dismiss rape. It's a horrible crime. And we on the left have been fighting, and feminist groups have been fighting for the last 20 years to get rape criminalized, to get police to treat rape seriously as a crime in many locales. To get the police to realize that the victim isn't guilty, it's the victimizer. Well, I heard the story. The Serbian Bosnian commander who said, go forth and rape. That story was traced to some UN personnel. They never came up with the name of a Bosnian commander. Would he actually go and say that? And the reports that the Bosnian Serb army raped 50,000 to 100,000 Muslim women? Do we not pause and again say 500 preemie babies? Wait a minute. The Bosnian Serb army was only about 30,000 men, most of them locked in desperate military encounters. What's going on here? What are you talking about? Common sense would dictate that these stories be treated with some kind of skepticism. Just the other day in the papers, the headline read, Serbians pursue rape policy, Kosovo refugees say. And I read the article very closely. It finally got down way, way down at the bottom. You usually got to go about 10 or 15 paragraphs before you come across some flickers or something. And the whoever it was taking the story, the official in charge said the rapes have numbered in the dozens, a very few dozens. So very few dozens rapes. Again, not to make a very few dozens. One rape is one rape too many. A very few dozens. But you know, if that's the problem, let me tell you that in LA County in the last 3 months there have been a very few dozen rapes also. If Clinton wants to fight rape, I know where he could start, you know. He could start right in Washington, D.C. He could start up on Capitol Hill. He could probably check around in the Oval Office, actually. There was the infamous Sarajevo Market Massacre. The Serbs were blamed for it until the story leaked out by French TV that the UN knew that Muslim extremists had bombed the crowd in Sarajevo in order to induce NATO involvement. It was discovered that the explosion did not come from a Serbian artillery shell, but from a planted bomb from Muslim sources. International negotiator David Owen, a Briton who worked with Cyrus Vance, in his memoirs, in his book, it's out, you can read it, Balkan Odyssey, page 262. He said that the NATO, he himself admitted, the NATO powers knew that it all along that it was a Muslim bomb, but they kept that quiet. In Kosovo, in the fighting for a year and a half in Kosovo between the KLA, the so-called Kosovo Liberation Army, and Serbian forces, by KLA, the KLA sources said 2,000 dead. The original figure was 800. When the KLA took over that news, that PR outlet, they jumped the figure from 800 to 2,000. When my assistant Peggy Karp asked the bureau chief at the San Francisco Chronicle, how did it jump from 800 to 2,000? He said, we all wondered about that too. It lifted quite a few eyebrows. But now the figure was out. 2,000 killed in this war. Even 2,000. That included both sides, including Serbian policemen, including Albanians who didn't want to collaborate with the KLA, including Serbian civilians in villages. 2,000. That, my friends, is a civil war. That's an insurgency. That's not ethnic cleansing. That's not genocide. The massive exodus of refugees. Please remember that the exodus of refugees from Kosovo came after the U.S. bombing started. That's when they started coming out. Just as you would get the hell out of here if you were getting 600 strikes a day in this region, you would want to go off somewhere else. You might even go as far as going to San Diego or whatever. I don't know. That was a joke. It didn't work. Um, 50,000 Serbs have left Kosovo to escape the bombing. Are the Serbs ethnically cleansing their own people? If there have been atrocities, murders, executions, and I'm sure there have been, of people, let's say that escalation has come after the U.S. bombing. So what the U.S. is now doing is using the exodus, is using the violence that's been caused, that's a reaction to the bombing, as an excuse to continue the bombing. There's still fighting going on. There are KLA units in Kosovo, and the Serbs are still fighting with them. And that includes, of course, cleaning out or telling people to evacuate whole villages and regions, and probably killing people too. If you want to stop that killing, then you should come out against the bombing of Kosovo and Yugoslavia. Now, this propaganda process, it's not as if we haven't seen it before. It's so blatant. It's so obvious. Gaddafi of Libya, before they started aerial strikes against him and before they imposed sanctions on Libya, what did they call him? These are actual quotes. A Hitlerite megalomania, a pathological liar. You know, it's really very... I remember back in the 80s, I go around lecturing, and people Gaddafiing all over the place. What about Gaddafi? Gaddafi, Gaddafi, Gaddafi bag, Gaddafi, danger, Gaddafi, go and get your mama, Gaddafi. What about Gaddafi? I said, you didn't even know who the hell Gaddafi was 2 weeks ago. You know, it's kind of scary. You couldn't have even found Libya on a map, and suddenly you're worried that Gaddafi, a nation of 3 million people with a ragtag army of 50,000, somehow is going to come and get you. Gaddafi's real sin was that he led a colonel's rebellion back in the 1960s. He kicked out a corrupt social order that was of a kind that you found in Saudi Arabia. He kicked out the people in column A, and he confiscated the oil, and he started using some portion of the profits to develop the country. Reforestation, clinics, schools, using it for the people in column B and C. That is intolerable if you are a member of the Fortune 500 or if you're one of those select persons in column A. That was Gaddafi's real sin. Noriega of Panama, quotes, real quotes, a swamp rat. That was said by that liberal, Dan Rathers. Call him a swamp rat, a jungle snake, a wily jungle snake. Other ones, Peter Jennings on ABC. one of the world's worst drug thieves and scums. Somebody else on one of the talk shows, a Hitler admirer. Saddam Hussein of Iraq, the butcher of Baghdad. That may be true to some degree, but that was before. They never. That was when he was our ally. A madman, a beast, worse than Hitler. Each one of them were charged with atrocities, acts of aggression. Each one of them then had their people demonized by proxy and had their countries attacked by U.S. forces. Each one of them was likened to Hitler. Milosevic, Bill Clinton, who learned his lessons well. Milosevic called by Bill Clinton a new Hitler. The Hitler thing keeps coming up, doesn't it? Which, by the way, isn't even a correct representation of Hitler. See, to see this as a demonized thing. I mean, to blame all the crimes of Nazism on Hitler is an old ploy. Ronald Reagan did that at Bitburg. He said, all of this happened because of one man alone, some demonic genius who just kind of led everybody else astray. See, that evades the whole question of what Nazism was as a social force, what class interests supported it and financed it, and who it benefited when it came into power, and who it hurted, who it hurt. The New York Times did its dime store psychobiography on Milosevic. You know, the New York Times is written by such brilliant people. They're so brilliant, you know. They must be because they say so themselves, they think so themselves. They're so brilliant, they're so smart. So when I read the New York Times, you know, I get very excited because I know I'm going to get. And this is what the New York Times said about Milosevic. As a youth, Mr. Milosevic was a pudgy loner. Now, in the American political lexicon, being a loner is enough to qualify you as a psychotic, evil kind of creature, you know? You must be an assassin if you're a loner, right? Lee Harvey Oswald was a loner. He wasn't even the assassin. Timothy McVeigh was a loner. Hinkle, the guy who shot Reagan, was a loner. These people all have friends and family, but they're loners, you know. That's the worst thing, you can be a loner. Yeah. But Milosevic was something even more serious. He was a pudgy loner. Now, pudginess is un-American. Of course, if he had been lean, then he would be a lean loner. And that would be bad too. So it's best not to be pudgy or lean. But let me read you the whole quote. Let me take it from the top, because this is the New York Times, right? As a youth, Mr. Milosevic was a pudgy loner. That's two strikes, pudgy loner. Who shunned sports, strike three. And who wrote poetry, strike four. I mean, do you need any further evidence that this is a psychotic killer nerd here? The Times goes on. Today, Milosevic is often described in Serbian profiles as reclusive and moody, with few friends. Though in public appearances and interviews, he can be as effusive and happy as a door-to-door salesman. It's fascinating, isn't it? The New York Times, they're so smart, you see what I mean? A reclusive, an effusive reclusive. Isn't that nice? How does that work? How do you do that? You sit sort of by yourself and you gush, is that it? Even the managing editor of Foreign Affairs, and again, that established, the leading establishment journal in America on U.S. foreign policy, Foreign Affairs, the managing editor, he says, quote, Milosevic, who rules an impoverished country that has not attacked its neighbors, Yugoslavia hasn't attacked anybody else, is no Adolf Hitler. He is not even Saddam Hussein. Well, aren't you putting too much blame on the U.S. leaders? It's not class interests, column A, column B. It's nationalism. That's the real motor force behind all these conflicts. That's what I hear some people say. Well, let me tell you about ethnic enmities. If people are living together in a society with some measure of hope, prosperity, stability, they tend to get along. And people were getting along in Yugoslavia. So Yugoslav woman I met who said, one more generation, these differences would have been gone. One more generation. There's a lot of intermingling. There's a lot of intermarriage even. Maybe less so in Croatia, where you had, you know, the Croatians took most of the northwest, the Serbs had most of the southeast. But in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the intermingling was incredible that was going on. When things start going bad, when you start getting aid cut, credits cut, sanctions, mass unemployment, then there are people who want to jump ship. And when the separatists got all the money and guns and backing of the U.S. national security state, then you can certainly start breaking people up and singing them against each other. And the CIA was very active in Bosnia doing that. Don't take my word for it. You don't believe the CIA was in Bosnia? Read the headlines. Manchester, London Guardian, November 1794. CIA agents training Bosnian army. The London Observer, November 20, America's secret Bosnia agenda. The European, November 25, how the CIA helps Bosnia fight back. So while pretending to work for harmony, the U.S. has supported the most divisive reactionary forces from Croatia to Bosnia to Kosovo. I think I've said pretty much enough. Let me just point out to you that NATO is right now in violation of its own charter. NATO's charter says you cannot engage in military actions except against an aggression committed against one of your members. NATO is in violation of the UN charter. You cannot engage in collective force actions like this against someone who hasn't attacked you except without a UN mandate. What is international law is totally in shreds right now. And what gives the U.S. leaders the right to intervene in this way? The U.S. has totally discarded any kind of traditional diplomacy. You know, traditional diplomacy was a technique of give and take, offer, counter-offer, proposals, bluster, bluff. You put your hand on the sword, but you never pull it out of the scabbard all the way. You negotiate, renegotiate, you pull back your ambassadors, you stop, you say we will resume, maybe we come back, talk again, and you both sides leave the table, never fully completely content, maybe one side much more discontent than the other, but never to the point of war. That's what was traditional diplomacy was about. It was a mode of mediation, a mode of trying to come up with workable solutions. U.S. diplomacy is something else altogether. U.S. diplomacy has made traditional diplomacy look very good. The U.S. issues a set of demands. It did this against Nicaragua. It did this in Iraq. It did this in Yugoslavia. It issues a set of demands. The demands are treated as non-negotiable, even though they're called accords or agreements, as in the Rambouillet agreements. It's finally coming out what some of us have been saying. Section B of the Rambouillet agreements said that the NATO forces that would go into Kosovo would have the freedom to go throughout all of Serbia and all of Yugoslavia if they so chose. Demands that no sovereign country can ever find acceptable. The other side's resistance, or even its hesitancy to totally accede to total surrender, is then paraded in our media as stubbornness. Milosevic snubbed these offers and proposals. To fail to completely accede to the demands is seen as an unwillingness to negotiate in good faith. U.S. leaders announce they are running out of patience and they start bombing. There was another step in the case of Kosovo. Both forces were negotiated to withdraw. The Serbians withdrew their military, the KLA withdrew, and then the KLA came back in and started taking over. It was all to their interest to come back in, to provoke an encounter, to get NATO in. It was all to the Serbian interest not to come back in, not to provoke an encounter. Once the KLA came back in, the Serbs came back in again. And then they said, both sides are fighting again. Milosevic obviously is not interested in coming to terms. We have only one thing left, and that's to take action. The same thing happened with Iraq. The Iraqis were ready to negotiate the withdrawal of Iraqi forces from Kuwait. And the Bush administration even called that the nightmare scenario. If they suddenly got up and started withdrawing, we would not have the opportunity to attack. Well, I want to read to you something from a woman who lives in Belgrade. She's a member of the Green Party, member of the Greens from Belgrade. This is off the internet. You can't get this in the U.S. media. This is on the internet. Serbia is one of the greatest sources of underground waters in Europe, and the contamination from U.S. explosives and depleted uranium will be felt in the whole surrounding area all the way to the Black Sea. NATO is bombing factories. The workers in the greater part of our industrial complexes have decided to make a living wall around their working places. They are not doing this because they are only defending their country, but also because they have become so impoverished by the years of sanctions that the destruction of factories would mean condemnation to a poverty equal to total starvation. In other words, they're defending the only thing they have left, which is their social capital, these factories that they've built. NATO chooses extremely dangerous targets. The municipality of Gračka has been hit on the territory of which the nuclear reactor Vinča is situated, containing a great storage of nuclear waste. The municipality of Pančevo has been hit, on which the petrochemical factory and the factory for the artificial fertilizers are situated. By the way, since then, now Hungary has been reporting, Romania, northern Italy, other places, possibly Greece, that these fumes, these places have been hit, and these fumes are escaping all over the place. The municipality of Barič has also been hit with the great complex for the production of chloride. The English isn't that perfect, but you're getting it, I guess. Which is using Bhopal technology. You remember what happened in Bhopal, India? 4,000 people died, terrible death. When these fumes escape. It is not necessary for me to explain what the blowing up of one of these factories would represent. Not only Belgrade, which is situated at 10 kilometers away, would be endangered, but the rest of Europe too. On the second day in the Belgrade suburbs, a factory for the chemical production and a rocket fuel storage was hit, causing a toxification of the surrounding area. Four national parks have been hit. All members of the International Association of the National Reservations. You have to realize that Yugoslavia is among 13 of the world's richest biodiversity countries. And she goes on to talk about the Serbian cinema archives being hit, Orthodox cultural churches, medieval churches that are on the UNESCO heritage list, and the effects the bombings have had on women and children. Old people and children who are unable to hide in shelters, the effects it's had on hospitals, the lack of water and such. NATO announced they're going after the Yugoslav water system. When you hit a country's water system, as happened in Iraq, you are now committing bacteriological warfare. When you hit the water system, you hit the life support system of any society. Water is needed to survive, water is needed for cooking, water is needed for cleaning, water is needed for human waste elimination. Without water, there's no food. Without water, you get typhoid and the like. And when the warm weather is coming now, you can expect this to be happening. And she goes on. I want to read one other thing, then I'm going to wrap it up. I've been going too long, I'm sorry. Okay, I was looking for reassurance. Oh, all right, I've got about 5 minutes. Now, I want to read, this is a statement by an American named Tom Watson. Tom Watson wrote this 100 years ago when William McKinley craftily moved the United States in a war against Spain. The war against Spain we heard in our media was to save the poor, abused, oppressed Cuban people who were, while the Spaniards were committing atrocity after atrocity. These atrocity stories, most of them, the Spaniards were not angels in Cuba. I'm not saying that. But these atrocity stories, most of them came from the desk of William Randolph Hearst and others who wanted the U.S. in there. The goal was not to liberate the Cuban people. The goal was to take all of Spain's possessions from Puerto Rico to Cuba to Guam to the Philippines. The first U.S. military action in the war against Spain wasn't even in Cuba to go so supposedly. Every day, we must go in there and rescue those poor Cubans. Every day, more of them are getting killed. The goal was, in fact, to attack the Philippines. And Admiral Dewey went in and destroyed the Spanish fleet and took over the Philippines to begin a war which lasted for 6 or 7 years, killing over 100,000 Filipinos. And the Springfield Republican, the newspaper, which supported McKinley, which supported intervention, suddenly wrote an editorial and said, "What is this war all about? We thought it was to rescue the Cuban people from Spanish atrocities." You see, there's a mass line, and then there's an inner line. The mass line you put out to people, and sometimes people in your own organization and your own party and even in your own agency believe that mass line. But you know what it really is. The real policy was the large policy, L-A-R-G-E, they called it. A group of people, which included Teddy Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge. And the goal was to make the U.S. a Pacific power. And the way to do it was to take Spain's colonies. And we needed a war against them. Plus, we were facing terrible economic conditions at home. And we needed a war. Teddy Roosevelt said, "We need a war. Any war will do. We needed to distract the American people to get them behind the flag." And this is what Tom Watson wrote. He was a populist leader who challenged both political parties and got elected as populist governor and as a senator on the populist party ticket in 1898. Who gets the benefit of the war? The bond seekers, the capitalists, the railroads? National bankers will profit by this war. The new bonds give them the basis for new banks, and their power is prolonged. The munition makers will profit by this war. The privileged classes all profit by this war. It takes the attention of the people off economic issues and perpetuates the unjust system they have put upon us. Politicians profit by the war. It buries issues they dare not meet. What do the people get out of this war? The fighting and the taxes. What is the United States doing in this war with Spain in the first place? True, Spain is oppressing Cuba, but so is England oppressing Ireland, Egypt, and India. France is oppressing Siam and Madagascar. Turkey is oppressing Armenia. Should we then take up arms against the oppressors of the world? We would more likely end up by becoming oppressors ourselves. The Spaniards and Cubans were bushwhacking one another and killing from 3 to 5 men at a battle. We have gone down there and killed more people in 3 months than they would have killed in 13 years. If the Cubans were starving before, who feeds them now? What are we going to get out of this war as a nation? Endless trouble, complications, expense? Republics cannot go into the business of conquering and still remain republics. Militarism leads to military domination, military despotism. Imperialism smooths the way for the emperor. Unquote. And that's what Tom Campbell, Republican congressman, that's the point he was making. This president is in violation of the NATO Charter, he's in violation of the UN Charter, he's in violation of the War Powers Act, he's in violation of the U.S. Constitution. He's waging a war. If we acknowledge that one individual can take a whole nation into war whenever he so chooses, then you don't have a presidency, you don't have a constitutional system, you don't have the debates they're supposed to have, you have an emperor. That's what an emperor does. That's what an emperor can do. He can command a whole people. And apparently, with the use of the media, he can command the minds of a lot of our friends, too. I remember during the Gulf massacre, a student saying to me, well, this is where you and I differ, because I have faith in President Bush. I trust him. I said, wait a minute, you have faith in President Bush? You mean like my Italian grandma had faith in St. Anthony? You light little candles to President Bush, do you? He said, oh, President Bush, Chabelle, you have faith? What the hell are you talking? Are you talking religion here? This is politics? You have faith? You trust him? Trust unquestioningly? Trust is something that you give to special, close loved ones and members of your immediate family, and even them, check them out once in a while, right? The essence of democracy isn't faith or trust. The essence of democracy is distrust. It's accountability. It's exposure. It's challenge. It's debate. That's what it's about. That's what we've been fighting for all along. So it's like Vietnam all over again. And then we have some other people who say, well, I'm against the bombings. Well, the bombings aren't working. No, the bombings are working. They're doing just what they're supposed to do, which is to destroy and shatter that country, to splinter it apart and drive it down into the ground. Not only that it'll be down and prostrate now, but that it will not rise again, to smash it into so many pieces that it will never recover. And they're destroying a part of our planet, by the way. That thing from the Belgrade Green woman, the lady that I read, would tell you, Yugoslavia is a part of our planet. Those water systems, that biodiversity, all of that, that's part of our common heritage, and that's being destroyed. The bombings are working. Well, we can't just pull out. I used to hear that in Vietnam, too, already. What would you say we should do? We can't just pull out. Oh, yes, we can. You can do it with two words, ceasefire, and then two other words, NATO disband. We don't need you anymore. They could pull out. We have to do something. Call the White House. Easy number. I'll give it to you. 202-456-1111. Even you can remember that now. 202. I know your memory isn't what it used to be. 202-4. Everybody say it together. 202-456-1111. I love these group things. You're supposed to do that. It brings us all together. Call the White House, call your Congress people, your media, ask them why they are mouthpieces for the State Department and the Pentagon, why they don't have a variety of opinions in their media. Call them, send letters, write letters to them, get on the internet, organize, talk back, demonstrate, agitate against the lies and the homicidal violence. The thin, frail voice of reason and democracy can become a mighty chorus and a strong resistance. I've seen it happen before, and we can make it happen again. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just going to take a few questions, so it's just getting very late and my voice is giving out. I didn't like this amplification system, so we'll just take it. Okay, no more after, how about just three or four? Yeah, make you the last guy, right? Thanks. Go ahead.
On a different subject, Dr. Freddy, if I may, I'd like to hear your views on why hemp is illegal here.
You know more than I do. The question is, why is hemp illegal to use?
Industrial hemp.
Well, I think it was the alcohol industry that got it banned back in the turn of the century, wasn't it? And that's what it was. It's too efficient an intoxicant.
How come the, I don't know what the left or whatever, why have we allowed ourselves to be beaten on vocabulary? Why does freedom now belong to the right?
I couldn't understand you, sir.
Okay, why does the left, or whatever we want to call ourselves, why have we been beaten in the dialogue? You're a speaker. You know about vocabulary. Words such as freedom. Why did we give that to Ronald Reagan? Mainly freedom. Other words, we're being beaten in the dialogue, and we're not going to be able to change what you spoke about until we get the dialogue back on our court.
Well, that's what I give my life to doing, which is to get the dialogue back. But to answer your question, you should know why. Do I have the same audiences and backing and exposure that the Ronald Reagan people do? No, we don't. They control the media. They control. We live in a monopoly media situation. It's not a democratic system. It's a very hard fight and hard uphill struggle. And the sooner you realize that, the better we'll all be. Yeah.
In a recent interview with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, Christian Amanpour of CNN said that in no uncertain terms that CNN would put peace activists on payroll as pundits. My question for you, Dr. Parenti, is would you consider applying for one of the many open positions?
No, that's bullshit. They would never take me. I've had experiences like that. In Dirty Truth, I give an example of NPR calling me up and saying, we have Cokie Roberts and who was the other guy who used to be on NPR? What? Phillips. Kevin Phillips. We have Cokie Roberts and Kevin Phillips, and we want to broaden it out. And I always thought to myself, well, how about deepening it a little, not just broadening it out? Your name keeps coming up. We inquire around, would you like to be another announcer? I said, yeah, sure. I would. I'd be interested in that. Okay. Could we call you? And, you know, you would come to a little, like, a retreat where we'd all meet, blah, 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 and this and that. I said, yeah, that'd be good. All right. Yeah, I'm certainly, very much interested. And I told friends, and they said, why aren't you more excited about it? I said, because it's not going to happen. What the hell's the matter with you? What planet do you live on, for Christ's sake? They're going to have me on national media as a commentator? They can't even get even the diluted ones, you know? They do not get anybody on who talks about column A and column B. If you talk about that, you don't go on the media. So, because you're talking about reality. You talk about power, capital accumulation. That is not on. They don't do it. Fidel Castro was right when they said to him, why don't you allow some anti-communists on your media? He said, we will when you allow communists on your media. With a communist with a small c, or whatever. Or socialists, at least. Okay, next question. Folks, go ahead, yeah, hi.
The gist of your talk tonight that I got as far as what's going on in Yugoslavia is that Milosevic is a total victim, that he did not commit any attack. His troops were not in Kosovo and the KLA,
right. That's what you got, of course.
Yeah.
Right, that's always the way. If you say atrocities are committed on all sides, if you say that there's been a demonization, then of course what you hear is that Milosevic is a total victim, that he's really a sweetheart, I do believe, by the way, that the Serbs were more the victims than the victimizers, certainly in Bosnia and Croatia, that's what happened. It's absolutely not true. English is my mother tongue, and you speak it very well. I said in English, I said atrocities were committed. All right, all right. Sit down, brother. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. All right. Take it easy. Take it easy now. Good, good, good.
No, he didn't go to that magnitude.
Oh, okay.
You minimizes this. Hawaiians are dying out right now. Goddamn.
Hey, all right, shut up. That's enough. Watch your language and calm down and sit down. We'll talk about it later. Just sit down. That's enough. That's enough out of you. Go ahead.
Well,
I told you atrocities were committed on all sides. I said, look, in World War I, the British propaganda ministry planted stories in the U.S. about Germans bayoneting Belgian babies and laughing about it all. Those stories were false. Does that mean that Germans didn't do any shooting? Yeah, of course there were killings. In World War II, we saw there were killings on both sides. Grudge killings. The airborne divisions in northern France would kill German prisoners. The German prisoners would there was retaliation on both sides.
Yeah,
war crimes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, but my point is, you know, it's I separate the people from the government, you know, in most of the country. And did Milosevic's military go into Kosovo, and what was the reason?
Kosovo is Serbia.
Well, that's one view, and there's an alternative view.
Well, you know, let me say this. In the 1980s...
I mean, the Indians don't want... They don't think that this country belongs to the United States.
All right?
So if you say Kosovo is Serbia, you know?
Can I answer your question?
Yeah.
In the 1980s, there was really massive infiltration of Albanians coming across the border from Albania into Kosovo. In 1945, the Serbs made up about roughly 35 to 40% of the population. Now, you see in the media all the time it says Kosovo is 90% Albanian. That's a KLA statistic. The official statistics today put the Albanian population at about 65% or so, with the rest being Serbs, 250,000 Serbs, over 100,000 Romani, we call gypsies, Turks, Montenegrins, Macedonians, all sorts of... There's about 15 different ethnic groups in Kosovo. And a lot of the villages were wiped out by KLA people back in the 80s when the police in Kosovo were Albanian. Milosevic cracked down on Kosovo when he went down there, gave a talk. A group of Serbs got up to protest about the treatment they were getting. They started getting beaten up by Albanians, and the Albanian police did nothing. He was absolutely horrified and shocked, and he moved in. Now, when he first came in, he was hailed in the Western press as a charismatic personality and our guy. The guy's an ex-banker. He is a Serbian nationalist. And they thought he could be a good tool in the dismemberment of the country. When they discovered that he wasn't their tool and their boy, and that he was more of a problem than a tool, then he suddenly started getting demonized. Now, have the Serbs committed atrocities? I'm sure, especially the paramilitaries, I'm sure. When you start getting bombed and you have a hostile population...
No, I mean before the bombing.
No, okay, but KLA own sources said 2,000 dead. That's not genocide or ethnic cleansing in a year and a half of fighting. When you start getting bombed and you have a hostile force, the KLA there, you start moving against that whole area and that population. Most of the refugees have come from the southern rim of Kosovo. Not all of Kosovo has been emptied out. There's 100,000 Albanians living in Belgrade. They have Albanian businesses with Albanian names on them. They're not being ethnically cleansed or murdered or atrocities against. So what I'm saying is don't be led around. And even if the worst of these stories are true, does that become grounds for this?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, but if there were...
Then we agree on that. Let's go on to the next speaker. Then we agree. No, I don't think so.
Considering that before World War II, many wealthy people supported the political party, they went on to be the Nazi party, then those same people turned around and generated great wealth off of World War II, do you think it's an inside joke when people call these other leaders Hitler? That gold mine inside joke among the Fortune 500, that this is another person they're going to make lots of money off of from arms and oil?
Who are you talking about?
When you hear reading the paper, they call people Hitler. When they like, is it an inside joke?
I think it's an outside propaganda. I think it's to convince people that this guy's very demonic and therefore should be wiped out. I don't think it's an inside joke.
I'm sorry. I know that your voice is going and that.
Yeah.
All right. But I've been waiting for a few years for an answer of this question. When you face a leader such as Hitler, what other forms of solutions are there than violence against Hitler? I know that maybe the American Empire is perhaps equally as corrupt and equally evil, but what kind of things do you do to stop the things that Hitler did?
Well, what you could have done is try to stop the things that Hitler was doing, which the U.S. didn't do, the Britain didn't do. Try to stop the fascist war against the Spanish Republic. They didn't do it. They were totally complicit with it. Try to stop the takeover of the Anschluss of Austria. Try to stop the breakup of Czechoslovakia. The Czechs were ready to fight against Hitler. They had a very good army, and the Russians, the Soviet Union was ready to ally with Czechoslovakia to stop Hitler. So you could stop him. I'm not a pacifist. Please don't mistake me. No, I'm not a pacifist. I think you should always practice nonviolence on those rare occasions you encounter it. But I'm saying there's a constant violence being done on us. There's a constant violence of our minds. I don't want to overdo the use of the word, but it's a constant coercion that we're getting. It's a very coercive situation, and this is what puts democracy at risk. And the only thing to stop it is by people organizing, speaking back, and not getting drawn in like that. But in the affairs of nations, most definitely, I would say the thing that should have been done. You see, your question presumes that the U.S. went in there and stopped an evil Hitler, and they had to use violence against Hitler's violence. That isn't what happened. What really happened was the Western powers didn't do a damn thing for so long. They wouldn't make an alliance with the Soviet Union to stop Hitler. They wouldn't save the Czechs. They wouldn't save the Austrians. All that stuff. They went along because Hitler was seen as a bulwark against Bolshevism and communism in Germany, and Nazi Germany was seen as a bulwark against communism in Europe. And so they thought they could use him until it was too late. And they got used. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Let's make this the last question, okay? My voice has run out. Yeah.
No worries. We down here in Southern California are not able to hear KPFA up in Berkeley, but we understand that a lot of things are being broadcast there that aren't available on more local stations down here, like KPFK. One of the great threats to democracy, besides the obvious bought and paid for corporate media, is the mediocritization of the alternative media that we've come to rely on. Can you tell us what's going on up in Berkeley now?
Well, I think that happens all the time with alternative institutions and media. They get infiltrated by people whose paid job is to mainstream it and dilute it, or two, people who just come in and have no politics of any kind, who are not working for someone else, and just come in and dilute it and want to play music and want to be touchy-feely, want to do this, and have no education about alternative political perspectives, but just see this as a station they can come in where they can then maybe someday jump off and go off to NPR or something like that. So that's a constant problem. It's a problem at KPFA, KPFK. They're all kind of hypocritical, all those stations, because they never play my stuff, except KPFK plays at Roy of Hollywood. If you want to stay up at midnight, he'll be playing. Yeah, that's an unusual thing. That was the exception that proves the rule. I'm glad to hear that. I heard that it was in the middle of the afternoon, and it wasn't a marathon subscription drive. That's very rare. Generally, what these stations do is they play me when they can make money on it. This is the part. In fact, I signed the KPFK release. Now, I bet you this is the part you don't hear on the air today. They're now under attack from Pacifica, which is really wanting to corporatize the whole thing. You know, run it under their clutch for their big salaries and the like. And which is really a dangerous thing, because then the whole, whatever little bits we have in these stations can get lost too. But not for a moment. And I got all sorts of people at KPFA saying, this is our community station, we're all together. Don't give me that stuff, because in fact, KPFA News is more conservative than NPR News. The people who run it, I believe, get another paycheck somewhere else. And they read the Associated Press wires. For 3 years, all I've heard is Bill Clinton versus the Republicans. When they wanted to give an alternative view to Bill Clinton, it was the Republicans, just like the major media. And we never got that alternative perspective. There are other programs on KPFA that are quite good, like Flashpoints, and Democracy Now is okay. She can be good. She can go this way, go that way. But so we should fight against the Pacifica takeover and the Pacifica repression. But we should also remind these people that they should not run their stations like little satrapies. That they should be more responsive to a truly alternative perspective, and there isn't enough of that on any of the Pacifica stations. Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen.